You're on Books and Arts. I'm Melanie Tate, filling in for Michael Cathcart this week as we bring you the best summer has to offer in the arts here on RN. Now, before we kick off this morning, I thought I should let you know a little bit about RN's arts coverage in 2015. Books and Arts will be now 6 days a week, with Michael bringing you the best arts coverage throughout the week, and I'll be bringing you coverage over the weekend on Books and Arts Weekend. Now, Books and Arts Weekend replaces Weekend Arts, where traditionally you'd find Poetica and Into the Music. Now, Books and Arts Weekend will just be an hour on Saturday. Let's look, though, at the very interesting people we're going to meet, the places we're going today. Auburn is a suburb in Sydney's west and one of the most multicultural in our nation. So what happens when a group of Afghan-Australian schoolchildren are given cameras and asked to show what they see? We'll meet two of the photographers and the woman who's taught them how to shoot and edit and do all that fancy photography stuff in just a moment. Plus, author Rachel Joyce creates characters so vivid and so beloved, she's often asked in the street about them as though they're real people. And her love song of Queenie Hennessy brings her most beloved characters even more to life. You'll hear from Rachel Joyce later this hour as well. And what could it be about the movie Wake in Fright that would encourage someone to go to Broken Hill rather than scare them off it for life? Well, singer-songwriter Darren Hanlon joins us to share his obsession with the Mineral City this morning. First today, the way we view our cities and our towns and homes is a completely individual thing. One person's bustling, exciting metro space could be another's overwhelming jungle of metal and noise. So how is it that a group of Afghan-Australian schoolchildren see a city that perhaps isn't the city they were born in and certainly is a city that is far away from many people they love? Afghans in Auburn is a photography exhibition that's just opened at the Peacock Gallery in Auburn. 13 Afghan schoolchildren turned their lens on their home suburb so we can see Auburn through their eyes. And with me today to talk about the project is Joanne Saad, the artist photographer who steered the project and mentored the young photographers, plus students Rafia Iram and Shakaya Razai. Thank you so much for coming in this morning.
Thank you.
We might actually start with you, Joanne. Mm-hmm. How did this project come about?
Okay, it was initiative through the ACDN, which is the Auburn Community Development Network, who run a lot of community projects and outreach projects. And so the arts officer there developed the project, which received funding from the Community Partnerships of Australia Council. And, yeah, and through AYA Association, just engaged, you know, young Afghanis to create a photographic project of the way that they saw, you know, how they saw their world.
Can you describe for us, for anybody who lives outside the surrounds of Sydney, of which there are many listeners today, what kind of a place is Auburn?
Oh, look, it's an extremely, like, a very, very diverse community, and it's always been the first point of when people, newly arrived migrants, they usually place them in Auburn. So there's a high, Sudanese community there, Afghani community, Southeast Asian communities. So it's, and you know, it was always known in sort of the 90s and 80s as a very highly populated with Turkish community as well. So it's very, very diverse.
So tell me about these young artists. How did you go about finding them?
Well, it was through, as I said, through the two organisations, through ACDN and through AYA. Shakai, can you tell me what AYA stands for again? It always says it perfectly.
Australian Afghan Hasnain Youth Association.
That's it. So it was through those organisations that they have they have groups and they develop programs for which targets, you know, different age groups. And so this was about a project that really wanted to give the opportunity for these young people to, as an expressive tool, to express how they see Australia. And because a lot of them have not been here for a long time either. So, and it's to see it through their eyes, telling their own stories instead of someone else telling them, mm-hmm. telling their stories or how they should see, you know, being in Australia.
So what was your role within this project?
Well, I was the photographer that came on board. So it was about developing workshops. So every week for sort of like over a 7-month period, we'd had weekly workshops. So on a Friday night, we would get together and it was about teaching them the principles of photography and then really steering them and finding out what they were really drawn to, because everyone is drawn to something different, people, landscapes, spaces, you know, nature. So it was about finding what they were really passionate or what their eye was really drawn to and to really develop that within them.
Now let's go to Shakaya and Rafia now. We might start with you, Shakaya, because you're just closer to me right now, right sitting right across. How did you come to photography?
Australian Afghan Hasnain Youth Association introduced us to this project. It's a really great project. Really enjoyed it. And Jenny O'Connell, I think her family name, introduced us to this project and told us about it, about this photography workshop. She told us we could come, use cameras to take photos of Sydney, the place that is my favorite one.
So Sydney is your favorite place?
Yeah, it's really my favorite place.
Really?
Yeah, before it was Tokyo, but now it's Sydney.
Right. So Sydney overlaps Tokyo. That's good to hear. Now, what was it about Sydney that you wanted to show in your photography?
I wanted to show everybody how great is Sydney, how life is beautiful in Sydney. Mm-hmm. And how people live in peace and they are just with each other, kind, and life is just beautiful.
So what sorts of things then were you taking photos of?
I was taking photos of nature, the beautiful nature of Australia. It's really nice. And cultural photos like Afghan carpets, Afghan dresses. Mm-hmm. And what else?
Things also like that you saw in the suburb, like the Santa.
Oh, yeah,
you know, that was a great Santa. Christmas lights and that. And it was
It's Australian traditional Santa and Christmas. Mm-hmm. It was really nice.
Let's go to you now, Rafia, too, because this isn't your first experience with a camera, is it? You've been carting around a camera with you for quite a while, haven't you?
Yeah, it's just been 3 months since I'm here in the photography class and in Australia as well. And it's
just like, 3 months in Australia?
Maybe four. Like, I arrived here in September.
Uh-huh.
So it's just been 4 months since I'm here. And in Pakistan, I used to take photos, but not with the professional camera. And here, it is my first experience with the professional camera here.
So tell me a little bit about the sorts of photos you would take in Pakistan and what kind of result you had on the camera that you had.
In Pakistan, like, I used to take photos not with nature, but with my family. And it was, like, always blurry because I never focused on it. But I always wanted to be a photographer and was my dream. And my family was, like, you're not going to become a photographer. Your pictures are always blurry. But when I came here, my friend told me about this class and I was pretty excited to join it because it's my dream.
That's wonderful. So it sounds like you got here and pretty much straight away you went into this photography class. Tell me about the sorts of things that you learned that means that now you've actually got photography in an exhibition as opposed to a few months ago where everything was blurry. What changed?
Like, when I arrived here, everything changed because I learned editing, I learned how to focus, I learned the cropping, I learned the maintaining the brightness and the color, and it all went really beautiful for me because I've never done it before, and just within 4 months, I got it all.
So the photography that we're seeing from you then is from a newcomer to Sydney. You know, it's all very new for you, I would imagine, Sydney, is it?
Yeah, it's all very new. This Sydney, like in Pakistan, it's a different culture, a different language, different mm-hmm. tradition. And in Australia, it's like everything new for us. It's just the beginning of a new life.
And what are the sorts of things then in your photography that you're wanting to capture about this new life?
It was like I chose the category, it was the empty places, mm-hmm. and I tried my best to just fulfill it because I told Joanne that this is my category and I'll just capture the empty places because I love nature and it's really calm.
Now that's interesting. You've both mentioned nature in our conversation. Auburn is a very, very busy place. It's bustling and there's always things happening and people walking everywhere and it's quite a crazy place, isn't it?
It is a crazy place.
Tell me about where you would go to find this nature within your photography, Shakaya.
well, our teacher or this community that supported us the first time took us to the new town. Mm-hmm. To the new town, it was a really nice place. There was paintings on the walls, and they were really interesting. And it was really my first time that I saw them. And our teacher Joanne, she showed us how to take a picture, and it was in nature, but it was really close to the business of Sydney or anything that related to Australia. I think it was art, like mixture of art, life, and everyday people's life.
Shakai, how long have you been in Sydney for?
Well, we arrived to Australia in 16th of October. I always remember the date. I never forget it. And I think it had been about 1 year and 5 months or 4 months, uh-huh. maybe.
So you've only just, you're both very new to Sydney and to Australia. I wonder then, does a program like this photography class, have you made new friends and met people through it?
Yeah, I think I made a lot of friends, about 10 or maybe 9. But I met a lot of new people and I became friends with them. And it's a new life. Mm-hmm. You have to make new friends.
Mm-hmm. And what about you? What about you, Rafia? Have you built a little community through this course?
Yeah, like I met new people. Like in Pakistan, there I never visited Afghans. I never met them. We all were Pakistanis. And here I just got a chance to meet Afghan people as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I pretty like them because they're just so friendly. And I never expected something that I will be here and making new friends and all.
You're listening to Books and Arts. My name is Melanie Tate, and my guests, you just heard from Rafia Iram and Shakaya Rezi. They're both young Afghan-Australian photographers. Well, they've just arrived in Australia only a few months ago and are part of an exhibition called Afghans in Auburn. Joanne Saad is an artist and photographer who has been helping these 13 young photographers along. Joanne, Rafia mentioned before that there were themes. One of the themes was it empty spaces that you were saying, Rafia? What other kinds of themes did you assign the photographers?
Well, what we did was we actually sort of really discussed themes and, you know, we workshopped and sort of brainstormed the ideas of things that they were really drawn to.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't so much about, you know, only having very limited themes to do. It was more about what they really wanted to explore, what they were actually drawn to. But the empty spaces came about because Rafia, like, with all of them, they just have an amazing eye. It's something that, you know, I say that I can teach them the technical, but to have the eye for photography, that's something that you can't teach. And, you know, this group of young people just blew me away because they just, the way that they saw things, you know, was, and what, how they were capturing that was, you know, quite amazing. So it's really, really, and it was exciting for me. You know, in 20 years of teaching, it was like sort of the best group of young people I've ever taught. And that was so inspiring, you know, for me. So it was something that they were just really drawn. Like Rafia came in one time and had just this really beautiful photograph at the train station. As you said, because Auburn is so related to being something so busy, but she found these amazing photographs where she captured that sort of isolation and that stillness and that sort of peacefulness. And I think that that's something that reflects from her anyway, as, you know, as a person. So, yeah, there was just this one other beautiful photograph I remember of Rafia's, that it was at a roundabout, and it was like the after we had all those rains in Sydney, and there was all this reflection, a beautiful large tree in the middle of the roundabout, and then you just had all the reflections of the, you know, from the water of the housing around there, but also of the trees, and it was just so still and so beautiful. It was great, but Rafia's also really fantastic at portrait taking, so she had different takes. So Her portraiture, you know, finding sort of urban spaces, but also nature. So really diverse. All of them had really, you know, they didn't sort of stick to one particular thing.
So it's interesting because you're both so newly here, and already you've had an art gallery opening. Has it ignited something within you that you think you'll keep cataloguing? This journey, I guess, of discovering Australia. Start with you, Rafia. Are you going to keep taking photos? It sounds like you will.
Yeah, because I want to become a future photographer, and I'm willing to have a course in high school as well. And I'll try my best to be a photographer in the future as well.
And Shikai, are you going to keep it going?
Obviously, of course. I love it. It just feels really calm when you take photos, you edit them, you have fun, and it helps your mind. It gives you exercise. And I really love it. I want to keep it going and become a really professional photographer like my teacher. And yeah, I just love it. I will do it.
And Joanne, I guess I'd ask you finally, for anyone who's not living within this community, what are they going to go along and see? What will they get insight into when they come along to the exhibition?
Oh, look, it's you'll see so many different things because they covered like various events, cultural events from the iftar event to the Diwali event because and there's just such a broad range, like just really unexpected, really quirky, you know, beautiful moments, just really the beauty that they see in you know, in the place that they live. And it's just that, just a different perspective and eye.
Well, thank you so much for coming in and congratulations on the exhibition. Afghans in Auburn is showing at the Peacock Gallery in Auburn until February the 7th. Joanne Saad, Rafia Iram and Shikai Razai, thank you so much for coming in today. I'm Melanie Tate and you're listening to Books and Arts. It's lovely to have your company. Coming up in just a moment, how would you feel if a man you once knew made a pilgrimage from one end of the country to another to be at your bedside? Well, the love song of Queenie Hennessy is up next.
Personal, surprising and essential listening. The Boyers are a broadcasting highlight on RN. The most recent address was from Professor Susan Corey, former president of the Australian Academy of Science. She's a medical researcher who doesn't mince words.
As renowned health advocate Mary Lasker famously said to the US Congress, if you think research is expensive, try disease.
Susan Corey on Our Scientific Future. The Boyer Lectures begin this afternoon from 12:30 on RN.
Well, from the Odyssey through to the Canterbury Tales and on to Thelma and Louise, stories of journeys are so, so popular. In 2012, Rachel Joyce told the story of a man who spontaneously walks the whole length of England thinking he might just save the life of his dying friend, whose name is Queenie Hennessy. He hasn't seen her in years, so he walks into the past and also into the popular imagination. The book, which is called The Unlikely Pilgrimage of Harold Fry, was, of course, a bestseller. How can it not be with a story like that? And it was longlisted for the Man Booker Prize. But what did the woman at the end of the journey make of this walk in her honour? Well, Rachel Joyce has written another book, and she answers that question. This one's called The Love Song of Miss Queenie Hennessy. And Kate Evans spoke to Rachel Joyce, who was, very appropriately, you might think, in a hotel somewhere in England.
I am a poor, wayfaring stranger, traveling through this world of woe.
Rachel Joyce, to talk about your latest book, we have to talk about its companion as well. So there's The Unlikely Pilgrimage of Harold Fry and now The Love Song of Miss Queenie Hennessy. They're not a series so much as, how would you describe them, companion pieces?
I have described them as companion pieces because for me it's almost as if the second book is the first book in reverse shot. It's an opportunity to sort of fill in the things that I couldn't get into the first book, not least because The Unlikely Pilgrimage of Harold Fry is about Harold's journey, and the tension for the book is really, you know, can Harold make the walk, and also how will Queenie be at the end? So I felt I couldn't have her side of the story in the first book, but it increasingly bothered me as time went on, because I felt the story wasn't complete without her voice.
Well, let's explain that then. So both books begin with a letter. What happened?
They do. So the first book, The Unlikely Pilgrimage of Harold Fry, begins with Harold and his wife sitting at a breakfast table. Harold's recently retired, and they live, I have to say, right in the sort of southern part of England. And a letter just comes out of the blue from an old friend, a work colleague that Harold hasn't seen for 20 years, to say goodbye, because she's dying and she wants to say goodbye to him. And this letter has come from the northernmost town in England. And in Australia, that, you know, the distance will be nothing. But for us, that's about as far as you can possibly travel. And Harold is so shaken by this news that he writes a little note to Queenie, a rather inept message, sets off to post it, and gets to the postbox and realizes that sending a letter isn't enough, and makes a spontaneous and completely unplanned decision to walk for her the length of England, his idea being that as long as he walks, she will live and wait for him.
I'm going there, no more to roam.
So it's Harold's journey, it's his awakening.
It is.
He becomes a focus for ideas and stories and longing. He changes, doesn't he?
He does change. I mean, not least because I think if you step out of your life, and also if you're a passerby, you will attract people and moments. You will witness things that you won't find if you stay in the comfort of what you know. So Harold's journey is obviously not just a physical journey. It is it's a journey into himself. It's a journey into the past. And it's sort of a journey just about the understanding of people, the kind of connection with strangers. That's very much the theme of the book.
So when did you begin to wonder in more detail about Queenie's story? So she's the focus of his pilgrimage, but she's not a huge presence in the first book. So
no, she's not. And as I said, I felt it was just important for the story that she wasn't a huge presence. She's remembered through Harold's perspective. But it was after I'd finished the book, and also as I began to talk to other readers about the book, I felt that for a story about journeys and indeed destinations, Queenie's journey and destination was really the biggest one, and I hadn't been able to tell it. I also felt, because I'd written the first book as a response really to my dad's dying, people had asked me a lot about his dying, and I was very open about it, and his death and his cancer. But the more I talked about him, the more I felt that that wasn't the sum of my dad. You know, he wasn't just the man at the end. He was the man, you know, who was an architect and a jazz musician and my dad and a father and a friend. And I felt it was the same with Queenie. She wasn't just, you know, a face and a woman in a hospice bed. She had a whole life that would have gone before that. And the more I thought about it, the more I could hear it and see it. And the more I felt I had to complete the story by writing it.
And so you gave your Queenie the same cancer that your father had, but then you also realised that they both had to have a full life.
I did. Yes, I did. Yeah.
And so in your latest novel, The Love Song of Miss Queenie Hennessy, we do learn more about her. I wasn't sure at first whether I wanted a love story. I'd liked her as an independent working woman who seemed defiant in a way.
Yeah.
And I wondered whether that's why it needed to be a secret love, unrequited love.
I only ever saw it as an unrequited love. And that's really why I called it a love song. It's not a love story. You know, it's a solo. But when I was writing the first book, I toyed briefly with the idea of would there have been something between Queenie and Harold, and I even tried to write it, and it was so wrong, I kind of had to just, you know, throw it away immediately, because I saw that the love story was between Harold and Maureen in the first book. But the more I thought about Queenie and her loyalty to Harold, and the more I kind of discovered her and wrote her, the more I could find a woman who would have fallen in love with a man like him and quietly held on to it and then had to run away from it.
But through her eyes we get a different version of Harold. In the earlier book, we meet him as he's been defeated by circumstances. Yeah. He's tall, but he's hunched over.
Yeah.
And then through Queenie's eyes, he's a dancing man. He's a vibrant character. Was that important for your imagining of them both?
Really important. Really, really important. Because when we meet Harold, he's in I keep calling it the first book.
And I know you've written
it's such
others.
A long title, I kind of feel I can't keep calling it out. But Harold has been, in my eyes, he's been asleep for 20 years. He's been broken by a tragedy in the past, and he hasn't resolved it, he hasn't confronted it, neither has his wife. And he is defeated, you're right. But we're not always defeated, you know, and it was great to have the opportunity to go back and discover the man that his wife would have fallen in love with, that Queenie falls in love with. And I hope that the reader can fall in love. I certainly fell in love with him.
Well, Queenie sees him dancing.
Yes.
And dancing is a real theme in the book, isn't it?
It became a very strong theme in the book. In fact, I thought a lot about why it had come about, and for a while I couldn't for the life of me see it, but then I remembered that in my 20s I went through a time, you know, like we all do, when I felt quite lost and a little bit, you know, a bit unknown, and you know, falling in love with the wrong people, and you know, and all that. And there was a period when I was on tour as an actress, and I went often in every town I went to a tea dance. And I didn't go with anyone, I always went on my own, but I always felt it was a bit like seeing your grandparents dancing. I felt very at ease, and I really saw the beauty of people dancing. You know, I don't mean kind of professional ballroom dancing. I mean people who just wanted to go somewhere with their rather special shoes and dance together and drink tea. And it sort of remained a bit special for me, and I think that's probably why I went back to it in this book. It sort of had a sort of resonance for me.
Well, and it has such a nice image of independence for Queenie, because she goes on her own. She's quite happy to be there on her own.
She's more than happy to be there on her own, yeah.
But she's an interesting character too, because she's a bolter. She's run as far as she can to the other end of England.
Yeah.
But one thing she does when she's there is build a sea garden.
Yes.
Can you describe that?
I'm very keen on gardening, and the more I thought about it, the more I loved the idea that this woman who has run away from Harold Fry, who feels she let him down, who has terrible secrets and things that she too has not yet come to terms with, should put all her creativity into the making of this beautiful garden that has it is right by the sea, so a very definite garden. Here it would be lots of flints and thrift and quite sturdy planting, but that she's also put in it sculptures and pieces of driftwood, I mean, you know, things that she's found that remind her of all the people she's left behind.
Because it's quite a stark landscape, as you describe it.
Yeah, it's a very, for us, it's a very open landscape. That stretch of coastline is quite unknown, but it stretches as far as you can see, and that, you know, the sky is quite wild, and so is the sea. But there's something about it that I really like, because it's so bold, you know what it is.
There's something there too about being on the edge of a cliff. And I'm trying to think here, I guess, about the connections with the Odyssey, because I was wondering what category of story you'd put them in, Harold and Queenie's story, because there's a quest, there's a road story, but it does seem to evoke both ends of the Odyssey, the journey, as well as the one who's waiting. So is Queenie a sort of Penelope?
Well, that's an interesting one, because I mean, the more I thought about waiting, the more I thought of it as a journey too. In a way, for me, Harold's journey is easier because it's a physical journey that has the stimulation of change, whereas her journey has to become one of accepting the present and not looking ahead and not I mean, you know, kind of leaving the past behind, but embracing the present. And the more I thought about it, the more I thought that is a very difficult thing to achieve, or it is for me anyway. I'm constantly running ahead to, you know, what might happen and how it will be. So I think of both books as being about journeys, but one is into oneself and the other is an outer journey.
I am a poor wayfaring stranger while journeying through this world of woe.
Well, Queenie's journey happens, well, it happens in many ways. We sort of get her life story in a sense. Mm-hmm. But we get that journey inside a hospice. So you're creating this intimate world.
Yeah.
And I guess that was drawn in part from your own observations of a hospice?
Well, it was. That was another thing that it kind of surprised me about the book, was that, I had already put Queenie in a hospice, so there was no not putting her in a hospice. But when it came to my dad's death, he had been very frightened of the idea of a hospice, and indeed a nurse. And he died at home. So I hadn't had that experience. But when I started writing the book, I knew that the first thing I had to do was to try and visit hospices and also to speak to volunteers and nurses if they wanted to speak to me who worked in them. You know, of course, the thing I realized was how wrong my dad had been about hospices and, you know, how that fear he had was so misplaced, and that the places I met were full of light, but they were also full of such kindness and such kind of positive energy that I really wished my dad had known that, you know, and not been so frightened. So it became important to me to write, you know, a celebration of the hospices and to say to people, we don't have to be alone when you're dying, and you don't have to be alone when you're caring for the dying. So my hospice became a pet place that did achieve the thing I was just speaking about, that really embracing the present and, you know, celebrating the present.
Well, and it is a gentle, interesting, but also a funny world.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I wondered how important it was for you to have irreverence in there. And so one woman stands out in particular, apart from Queenie, and that's Finty. She's a terrific character.
Yes, she's a force of her own.
Can you describe her?
She's one of those characters that I didn't specifically plan. She just seemed to turn up, and there was no avoiding her. She's kind of quite foul-mouthed. She says it as it is, but she has a selection of hats, different hats that she wears every day because she's got no hair left after chemotherapy, and nothing seems to faze her. She decides that at one point in the book, kind of crucial turning point for Queenie when she's feeling, maybe she can't wait. Finty decides that she is going to wait as well. And not only that, she asks everybody in the hospice if they will wait for Harold Fry. And she's just one of those women I think you would want to have around.
Now, there's also a nun there of unusual wisdom and compassion. Are you religious? Is this a spiritual story for you or a secular one?
It is a secular story for me. I'm not somebody who goes to church. But for me, increasingly, I know I find there are things that I believe in that are, you know, not about myself, but they're to do with, I mean, I think it's to do with other people and something to do with sky and land. So I sort of wanted to write a book that could be about faith when you don't have a church to go to.
Rachel Joyce there, speaking about her newest book, The Love Song of Miss Queenie Hennessy, published by Doubleday, and a companion piece to her novel, The Pilgrimage of Harold Fry. This is Books and Arts. I'm Melanie Tate, filling in for Michael Cathcart until next week. Coming up in a moment, Darren Hanlon tells us through his masterpiece choice why a film made him more than a little obsessed with Broken Hill.
The system of segregation is on its deathbed today, and the only thing uncertain about it is how costly the segregationists will make the funeral.
A pivotal moment in American history. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s historic struggle to secure voting rights for African Americans is now a feature film, Selma. RN is offering tickets to pre-release screenings. Look for Selma on the RN homepage.
So now I'm going to tell you in a lovely way how you can get some of those tickets. Now, on Friday night, US President Barack Obama hosted a private screening at the White House of that film, Selma, that you just heard about the civil rights campaign by Martin Luther King in 1965. The cast and crew were there at the White House, along with Oprah Winfrey, who was actually in the cast, and hip-hop artist Common. The film's already received critical acclaim, and its release marks the 50th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act in 1965. Now, here's how you can come along to one of those screenings. We're having screenings in Perth, Adelaide, Melbourne, Sydney and Brisbane in February before the film's actually released. And we have 100 double passes for every city. Isn't that terrific? To be in the running to see this film, which looks to set out to take at least one Oscar, although controversially has been left out of the Best Director category, just go to the RN homepage and look for the events and competitions. Just go to the competitions tab on the RN website to enter. And while you're at it, why not subscribe to the RN weekly newsletter, because you'll find out about things like this so quickly. That's more on our programs and our 2015 schedule. Each day this week, we're going to be bringing you one of our masterpieces, where we ask an Australian artist to share with us the piece of art that means most to her or him. Now, Darren Hanlon's masterpiece was the very first we ever recorded, actually. Darren, as you might already know, is one of Australia's best travelling singer-songwriters. He makes his way around Australia and indeed around the world, picking up stories and songs to share with his hungry and devoted audience. Here's Darren Hanlon's masterpiece.
Well, today I would like to talk about the movie Wake in Fright. It's a lost Australian classic from the 70s. There's been a lot spoken and written about this film, but I came to it probably before it got rediscovered. A few people had told me about it. There were the various copies floating around. I think Jay Katz found a copy from an American drive-in and showed it at the Annandale. And then I saw it also when they played it at the Chevelle. When they found the original negative, they wanted to preserve it, so they played it for one night only, and it was a sold-out session. They had all different people that had worked on the film speaking about it, and it just became legend. I was there with a lot of friends and a lot of people, and it was the first time for a lot of us. I remember the excitement after the film. You know, we all went to the pub across the road, and everyone wanted a beer, that's for sure. But people were just so excited that this film existed, and something that we were really proud of, this Australian film that we're proud that was made. It spoke to me because I spend a lot of time going out to these outback towns of Australia, whether it be to write or to play shows. I'm fascinated with the Australian town, and unfortunately a lot of them are dying, you know, because of industry moves towards the coast. And once upon a time, there was a lot more industry out there. Broken Hill, though, where the movie was set, it still has mining, you know, it still survives on mining, who knows for how long. But yeah, I've met these characters, I've met people that, it was just amazing that you see these characters on film and they can just remind you, you don't think they're acting. It seemed like a bit of a documentary to me. ¶¶ The film's about a school teacher that is stationed. He's an apprentice, so he gets stationed out there. He's heading home to Sydney and dreaming of Bondi Beach and his girlfriend waiting for him. And he gets to Broken Hill, which is called the Yabba. And he gets involved with the locals and loses his money and gets stranded. It's all about his involvement and his slow downward spiral. It's really hard to become a local out there. I think you have to almost live there for 20 years. I think Broken Hill still has this weird grading system. A grade means you're born there. C grade means you've moved there and you don't want to leave. And then if a C marries an A, you become a B. Yeah. It was originally a book by Kenneth Cook, and I think he was a journalist out there, and he based a lot of the characters in his book on real people that he met, which probably why it rings true as well. It was Chips Rafferty's last film, and he was born in Broken Hill, and it was Jack Thompson's first. When I first went to Broken Hill in the 90s to ask about the film, no one wanted to speak about it. I took a little dictaphone out and wanted to interview the locals, and I didn't find one single person that would talk to me about it. They were ashamed of it. Everyone wanted to talk about Mad Max, and even Priscilla, people were still a little bit weird about that. And I think it's slowly become this kind of you know, object of pride out there now. Like maybe it's I don't know what it is, but I think people maybe realize in what high regard people consider this film now. So, but back then, yeah, people would just say it's a bunch of rubbish. I believe, and this is just from articles that I've read, that it was maybe, you know, popular in the cities, and then in the country, they turned their back on it. And that's probably why it was just overlooked and it went missing. And it's still shocking. There's still scenes that are shocking today. I played it in New York for a bunch of friends, and I forgot to warn them about the kangaroo slaughter scene, and people were nearly throwing up. I felt really bad. I felt like I'd lost a few friendships in that by showing it. So it is shocking. It's still shocking. There were some friends of mine that were at the showing, and they were in a band called the Magnetic Fields. They had a movie. There was a documentary about their band that was playing at the San Francisco Film Festival, so they all flew over there for that. And just randomly, they were sat at a table with the director, Ted Kotcheff, and my friend Claudia from the Magnetic Field said, "Did you happen to make Wake in Fright?" And apparently he slammed his hands on the table and went, "Yes, how do you know about this? How do you know this film?" And she said, "Oh, a friend of ours played it in New York 2 weeks ago." And he said, "Who is this?" And she thought he was going to get angry because I'd played it without, you know, kind of illegally. And he said, I want his email address. So he emailed me out of the blue. And so suddenly I have this email from Ted Kotcheff asking why I played Wake in Fright. And I just wrote this long email back telling him how much it meant to me. And I've spent a lot of time in Broken Hill and what buildings are still there and which ones aren't. And so next time I went to New York, he asked if he could take me out to lunch, and I was like, of course. So he's a producer on a TV show over there, so I met him at the studios and he took me out to a fancy lunch, and he basically didn't stop for breath. I guess there's not a lot of people he can talk to about Wake in Fright because a lot of his, you know, American friends probably don't know the film, and at that time it had never played in New York, so he would just wanted to talk. So he just told me endless stories. He thinks it's his most perfect film. I think the legend behind it is something that makes it even more special. The story of the film after it was made, you know, is amazing, that it almost got, you know, completely lost. It was in a canister somewhere that was destined for destruction. It had some sticker on it saying, you know, this is to be disposed of, and they just found it a couple of weeks before that happened. So I think that the legend of it makes it pretty amazing, and I just don't think it doesn't have a peer, you know, that film. There's no other films that kind of speak to Australians that they can recognise. It's like looking in a mirror, I think, for a lot of people. For nothing else, it's a really entertaining film. I can just watch it over and over. It's one of those movies. There's probably, you know, probably everyone has five or so films in their life that they can just watch over and over, and it will still, you'll still see something new. There's so much detail in it. And I just think it's just a perfectly made film. It's a great story. It's and it says a lot about Australia.
Oh, isn't that a great soundtrack? Darren Hanlon there talking about Wake in Fright, the 1971 film directed by Ted Kotcheff, based on the book by Kenneth Cook. Now, that's all we have time for today on Books and Arts. Tomorrow we'll be bringing you Sydney Festival's Black Cabaret and a discussion on whether the time is ripe for the great Australian musical. And further to that, how can Perth be the great solution to that conundrum? To take us to the news, though, another highlight from Sydney Festival's music program, Perry Keys. Now, I saw Perry perform the other night at the Spiegel Tent, and he is just sublime. I'm very excited about playing this music for you now and hope that you become a Perry fan as well. It's called Mario Milano's Monero. Enjoy.
She likes girls and one day cricket. Used to watch the whippets run from beyond the Wentworth pickets from Harry's Cafe. The wheel to that river at Warrenora. Knows how it feels to have the beautiful